Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Two guests today, first and seconds, Yazid Saig of the Carnegie Endowment, will talk about the origins and aims of ISIS. And just after the bottom of the hour, Kali Okuno of Cooperation Jackson will talk about efforts to bring worker power and environmental sustainability to Mississippi. First, Yazid Saig. The recent terrorist attacks in Paris are being blamed on ISIS. Is this fair? And just who is ISIS anyway? Yazid Saig is a senior associate at the Carnegie Middle East Center in Beirut. Yazid Saig. What precisely are we to make of ISIS? Is it a religious movement, a state, a political movement? How would you categorize it?
Well, I guess it's all of these things. I'm not quite clear why we often try to shoehorn socio-political phenomena into single boxes. I think that most important is that ISIS is fundamentally a political phenomenon. It uses religion as many other movements have used either religion or some other kind of normative ideology that is used to present a worldview and a set of norms and a way of understanding life and the world. But above all else, the use of religion is then used in order to justify a particular power structure, a particular politics. And in this case, I think the Islamic State, and here I differ, I think, with a lot of commentary that you see both in Western and in Arab media, I think that the Islamic State is fundamentally an Iraqi phenomenon. It's an outcome of Saddam Hussein's style of politics, the manner in which he looked at the world, the manner in which he looked at his own society, the manner in which he constructed power and the purposes for which he did that, and in particular, the very central role played by violence in all this, i.e. the highly instrumentalized and highly graphic use of violence as a means of both intimidating enemies and creating this image of power. All of this, I can point to the legacy of Saddam Hussein, to particular episodes in the years between the early 60s and 2003, when he was finally overthrown. If you look at a whole range of Saddam Hussein's actions, you know, you can trace the line immediately into almost everything that ISIS has done. This is not to say that ISIS is simply a reincarnation of the Ba'ath Party, but simply that the people who have shaped what ISIS is and how it operates and how it wants to be seen have been formed, I think, entirely by the particular modes of power, politics, and violence that Saddam Hussein evolved in order to build his own power.
Saddam Hussein was at least nominally secular, and ISIS is not. What happened in the transition?
Well, I mean, that's the thing. You know, we, I think, assign far too much importance to this thing of these are religious nuts, and somehow that makes them totally different. Take, for example, the Nazi Party and Hitler. Can there be anything conceivable that was more extreme and radical than their vision of the world and of how to reorganize the human race? I mean, speak of radicalism and extremism, that was the most astonishing, astonishingly horrific and logically insane or insanely logical conclusion to a line of thinking that was about, you know, racist and exclusive and anti-Semitic and so on. And that was not done in the name of religion. That was done in the name of secular ideology, of nationalism. So let's not get, you know, that's a red herring. I think the fact that Saddam was secular, well, he was actually on social issues highly conservative. Starting in the 1980s during the war with Iran, he started to restore the power of patriarchs in Arab clans of Iraq, Sunni Arab clans in particular. He used them to enforce social control over their clan members, to ensure recruitment or conscription of their youth. He started to roll back, in effect, some of the gains made by women during the war years with Iran, when the men went off to the front in very large numbers, which forced the regime, the state, to bring women into the whole state bureaucracy, into industry, into production. There were massive social changes happening, and Saddam Hussein in the 1980s, and then especially in the 1990s during the sanctions on Iraq, restored a lot of the old style, very conservative social attitudes, very anti-women. He extended the influence of Islamic networks. One of his key deputies, Azad Duri, who, you know, is right now still a fugitive, unless he's been killed, it's not really clear what his status is, during that period joined the Sufi order, which has now emerged as the basis of the Baathist-influenced Naqshbandi army in fighting the Baghdad government in Iraq. So there was a lot of social conservatism partly taking on an Islamist face already happening in Iraq in the 80s and especially the 1990s. So, you know, let's not play with this thing that here's a secular guy and there's religious people. It's like looking at Egypt and you've got this new president, Abdel Fattah al-Sisi. He is very much not a secular person at all, but we portray him as the counter, the opposite to the Muslim Brotherhood. That doesn't mean he's not as obscurantist in his own way as the Muslim Brotherhood is.
Now, of course, everyone is assuming that ISIS had a hand in the Paris attacks. Do you believe that?
Well, I think it's probable, yes. I think on this occasion we can take this at face value. However, that doesn't really tell us all that much because, for one thing, it seems pretty much established now, I think, that in a number of countries around the world, we have people, local jihadist organizations that have appeared. They were already there. They were going to appear sooner or later as a result of their own country's deep social and political problems. And ISIS has achieved such a dramatic impact that there's a sort of franchise effect. These people all want to be recognized by the ISIS leadership in Iraq as being the genuine local representatives or franchise. Now, at the same time, I don't think that the central ISIS command, I'm calling it the central command in Iraq, the sort of the core ISIS, I don't think they spend much time so far investing a lot of effort, diverting resources, key, say, security officers being seconded to focus on setting up missions and terrorist attacks in Libya or Nigeria or Paris for that matter. I think this is happening, so far has been happening on the local initiative of these local people who want to show that they're part of the franchise. However, having said all that, there is a possibility that right now, if the 15 or so months of nonstop bombardment of ISIS in Iraq and Syria are having an effect, and it's starting to suffer the loss of income, maybe the flow of recruits and foreign volunteers is slowing down, its ability to recruit locally is limited because it's not clear that it has that much support on the ground. If, in other words, it's in a growing strategic predicament, it might then actually say, right, now is the time to start investing more of our thinking, our effort, our resources into going on the offensive further afield abroad in order to deter these governments that are putting so much pressure on us and to intimidate them and deter them. That could be, and I think we need more clear and definitive evidence, the sort of evidence that intelligence agencies have, which will tell us if people have been given the responsibility, key figures within the Islamic State security apparatus of Syria and Iraq, for instance, have some of these been put aside to form an external operations department or directorate, which is actually really investing its major time into this. Because operations on this scale take a lot of organization and planning. They require logistics. It's not a simple, easy thing. Maybe a one-off, twice-off. But after a while, if this is sustained, then we'll have to conclude that ISIS has actually shifted strategy and is now deliberately starting to try and open up a second front on a global level instead of the main front, which is Iraq and Syria. Keep in mind that the fronts opened up in Libya, Sinai, Nigeria, anywhere else. ISIS hasn't had to divert resources from Iraq and Syria for that. There are local people who've just taken this on. In other words, it's cost-free. But to start organizing attacks of this nature on a sustained basis in foreign countries, that is going to require a different level of organizational, operational, and financial input. And we're going to have to see evidence of that if that's what's happening.
How does their organization differ from that of Al-Qaeda?
Good question. I think it differs fundamentally in the way I discussed right at the start of this discussion, in that Al-Qaeda is not linked to any one territory. Its base in, you know, Pakistan or in Afghanistan, or wherever its leadership is today, or ever was in the past 20 years or so, that was not its home base. These people were exiles, they were nomads, they were footloose. ISIS, on the other hand, is an Iraqi organization at its core. Without Iraq, it ceases to exist. If you were to destroy ISIS in Iraq, in my view, then yes, maybe people in Sinai or Libya or wherever would carry on calling themselves ISIS. They wouldn't be the real ISIS. ISIS, unlike Al-Qaeda, is a highly territorial organization. It is very much a product of Iraqi politics, of Iraqi experiences, of Iraqi social dynamics. It is rooted in Sunni Arab clan society of northern and western Iraq. And if you look at the map of where it has achieved penetration in Syria, it has been almost entirely and exclusively able to act in the eastern and northeastern parts of Syria, which also have a strong clan society. The moment ISIS has tried to expand into western Syria, which is rural, conservative, Islamic, religious, it has failed to establish real roots there because society there is not clan-based. I think these are fundamental differences between ISIS and Al-Qaeda. And I think in a way this offers better opportunity to defeat ISIS because it has this very real physical territorial base that can be targeted.
I'm Sumit Yazid Saeed of the Carnegie Endowment in Beirut. The bombing, the U.S. has been doing it, its allies have been doing it, and then France intensified it as an act of retaliation. Is this accomplishing anything? You sometimes hear people say it only increases their recruits and increases their strength. What's the effect of this bombing?
Well, let's distinguish a sustained campaign like the one the U.S. has led since August, September last year versus sort of show strikes that are done and sustained only for a few days or a week or two. It would be great if France, and I guess not alone, but along with the U.S., along with Turkey and others, could actually put together, working with people like the Baghdad government, a plan for a very significant ground action, which will have to involve Western troops, frankly, if that's what we're talking about, because the Baghdad government has failed really to reform itself and to solve the deep problems within its politics, to deal with corruption on a massive scale and things that are behind the failures of the Iraqi state in the first place. The Iraqi army is not being built effectively enough, swiftly enough to take on the burden. So if you want a real impact, you need real ground forces. And if you want a quick impact at a time when the Iraqi army is not ready, at a time when Syria is torn apart, then clearly you need Turkish or French or American troops on the ground. If that is not available, then more airstrikes are just not going to tip the balance. And the question is, are the French going to maintain this tempo of operations, of airstrikes, indefinitely? I don't think so. I'm not talking about the rights and wrongs. I'm simply saying that this right now, you can understand as an immediate reaction, a demonstration of resolve. The question is, what are they going to do a few weeks further down the line? The US has answered that by maintaining airstrikes continuously. However, that said, U.S. airstrikes and allied airstrikes have in fact dropped very significantly over the past 6 months or so, certainly since the start of summer, and certainly also since the start of Russian operations. So it's clear that even the most powerful partner in this coalition, the U.S., is either unable or just doesn't see the point in maintaining a very high tempo of airstrikes against an enemy that at this stage is able to hold on and take the beating. It is interesting, I'll just add here, that a couple of days ago, the U.S. apparently struck a large assembly of oil tankers, trucks carrying oil that ISIS from ISIS-controlled fields in eastern Syria, and apparently destroyed 116 of these oil tankers. Now, that's interesting, both because this wasn't done previously, but also, of course, it means that ISIS has been able to maintain a certain level of oil production and oil export, and that now this is being targeted more and more aggressively. One reason I should clarify for your listeners why this has happened in the past, i.e. that ISIS was allowed to carry on with some of its production, I guess, is because a lot of this production is actually reaching local markets in Syria, people who are approaching their fourth winter without fuel, without heating, without fuel to run, clinics, surgical operating theaters, and so on. There is actually a need for this fuel, and so there's a balance. If you destroy too much of this in order to affect ISIS, you also risk affecting the civilian population. And ISIS doesn't actually produce the oil itself and sell it directly. It simply allows the local clans and social groups to do that and takes its own cut. So I'm just explaining that there's a lot of complexity to this, but apparently right now the US has decided to raise the costs for ISIS. Whether it'll do that continuously or just send a signal, it's not clear. Maybe we're talking about mutual deterrence. ISIS tries to deter the West by striking in Paris. The US deters ISIS and says, if you want to play that game, we can raise the cost for you to back off. We're going to have to see how this evolves, and I just pray, of course, that we, in the interim, we don't have to suffer more horrendous attacks, not just in Paris, but also what happened in Beirut last week when they struck the southern suburbs. And possibly, if it turns out that the Russian airliner that was brought down over Sinai was brought down by a terrorist attack, then we're talking about a massive cost to not just French people or Westerners, but also to other societies in the region. So, you know, I do hope that we move on to something else without more horrific loss of life.
Is there such rage across the Muslim world because of the U.S. invasion of Iraq, of Afghanistan, Israel's continued occupation of Gaza and the West Bank, that even if we're to destroy ISIS in some sense, that this rage is going to take up other forms elsewhere, and until we change that kind of policy, we're just going to face these sorts of attacks?
You know, I don't think that the West or the U.S. Have faced terrorist attacks over the last, say, 20 years as a direct result of the Palestine conflict and the failure to achieve Palestinian statehood and independence. Not only have Palestinians not been involved in any of the attacks at all, but it's very clear that when you look at what ISIS says about its goals, how often it mentions Palestine at all, which is basically very rarely, it's very clear that that is not what drives them. Now, what that means partly is that by resolving the Palestine conflict, you don't automatically make terrorism go away. It's not like that. Maybe there was a time when many people in the rest of the world could have restored their faith in U.S. policy, had the U.S. been even-handed on Palestine and helped produce a genuine solution. Now, these societies have broken up. Iraq, Syria, Libya, Yemen, they've collapsed as societies, as states. This is not about Palestine anymore. However, if you were to defeat ISIS in Iraq, then I think, once again, you're defeating a direct source of threat to Israel, as happened in 1991 when Saddam Hussein's army was kicked out of Kuwait, for instance. That created an opportunity for Israel to feel safe enough to make peace. And that is when Yitzhak Rabin was elected prime minister and made peace with the Palestine Liberation Organization. And that was, I think, a hugely important positive step. Now we've got the reverse in Israel, sadly. We've got a very right-wing government committed to colonization of the West Bank and East Jerusalem, unwilling to make serious peace, using every excuse in terms of Palestinian failures to justify not doing anything at all on the peace process. And yet, we've just had, thanks to the Obama administration, the ending of the Iranian nuclear threat, certainly for the foreseeable future. This is out of the picture, which is a huge plus for Israeli security. Were we also to destroy the Islamic State in Iraq, then, you know, Saddam Hussein's army is gone, ISIS is gone, not that it poses a direct threat to Israel anyway. And you're starting to change the whole dynamic with Iran. I think these are hugely important things. And there is no good excuse in terms of Israeli security to keep resisting moving forward on Palestinian statehood. it's getting harder and harder to see how that can ever happen, because there's so much polarization and distrust that's built up on both sides among Israelis and Palestinians. Sadly, I don't see that happening. If the U.S. is going to play a role here, it's got to start being a genuine, honest broker. It has not been that for at least 20 years, frankly.
But the series of outrages, not just leaving aside the Palestinian question, you know, the invasion of Iraq, the invasion of Afghanistan, what a lot of people in the Muslim world perceive as Western aggression towards them, increasing hostility towards Muslims, towards refugees in the Western world, is this going to contribute to ongoing aggression that even if ISIS is destroyed, there will be something else coming in the wings?
The Arab countries, the societies are undergoing huge, momentous historic changes. This is the result of 40 years of autocratic, authoritarian, at times dictatorial government, complete disregard of basic human rights in many countries in the region, extreme poverty, growing poverty. I mean, the Arab countries up to about 20, 25 years ago had some of the narrowest income gaps in the world, i.e., the gap between the richest and the poorest was not as wide as in any other part of the world. Now the gap is among the widest. You've got 40% of the population in countries like Syria, Jordan, Egypt, Algeria, Morocco, others, who are at or below the poverty line. Millions of people, let's say in Egypt, 1 in 7 people live in illegal housing and get no public services or infrastructure, and so on. This is what we're living. We are living the political consequences of 40 years of neglect of these trends, because as long as they weren't making trouble politically, we didn't have to worry. Now it's all blowing up in our faces, whether with the Arab Spring, the outcome of the U.S. invasion of Iraq. It's happening in different forms, in different ways, but over the last decade, we've seen a steady widening of the ripple effects, and they're bringing down one Arab state after another. I'm not saying all Arab states will go this way, but clearly this is not over. And out of this is coming new kinds of Islamic groups. Some are militant, some not, some armed, some not. And we're getting jihadism. And part of what's driving this in a place like, say, Tunisia or in Jordan, which are societies where almost all the citizens are of the same ethnicity and of the same religion, the deep, deep, deep divide is a class divide. I mean, you've got massive marginalization of huge numbers of people who have been neglected and ignored. The Arab Spring happened, revolution happened, political transition happened, and then the same people found that they were as marginal as they were before. And they are finally turning to alternatives, and sadly these alternatives now are the ones that seem to promise a complete change to these systems of government that have been selfish, self-centered, focused on middle-class urban folk, and that have been hugely corrupt. The level of corruption in many of these states is unbelievable. I mean, hell, we can all talk about corruption in U.S. politics, right? The one thing, though, that works there is that in return, you actually get quality service. You get highways built or you get whatever. But in Iraq, $500 billion of public money were spent in the first 10 years after the U.S. invasion, and not one single new hospital was built, not one new electricity power plant was built. Where did the $500 billion go? And so on. You know, we can take the list down the way through Yemen, through Egypt, through Lebanon. It'd be actually rather surprising if there weren't radical responses. I'm not saying the radical responses of jihadism are sensible, civilized, healthy, good, anything. They're horrific, totally to be fought. However, it'd be very surprising if there wasn't something extreme in response. What we're trying to look for, however, are democratic, liberal responses based on dialogue. And a lot of the time, as we saw in Lebanon this summer, when there was a grassroots movement that finally expressed disgust with the level of corruption, what you got is a huge alliance of almost every political faction in this country, along with big business, saying these grassroots people, they're communists, they're Islamic radicals, they're all sorts of strange things. All they were middle-class kids, really. You know, it's terribly hard making the shift. And unfortunately, the EU, the US, in places like Egypt have come along and they welcome people like Sisi. And they say, oh, we're so unhappy with your human rights. We do wish you'd do better, but look, here's your military assistance for the year. And you tell me how we get out of this.
That was Yazid Saig, Senior Associate at the Carnegie Middle East Center in Beirut. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Some of the threnody for the victims of Hiroshima by Krzysztof Penderecki, with the composer conducting the Polish National Radio Orchestra. Next, Kaliakuno. He is with Cooperation Jackson in Jackson, Mississippi, one of the poorest communities in the United States. In its own words, the organization's mission is to, quote, develop four interconnected and interdependent institutions, an emerging federation of local worker cooperatives, a developing cooperative incubator, a cooperative education and training center, and a cooperative bank or financial institution. You can find Cooperation Jackson on the web at cooperationjackson.org. Here's Kaliakuno. Welcome. So tell me a bit about Jackson first. It sounds like one of the poorest communities in the United States.
It is one of the poorest communities in the United States. Mississippi is one of the poorest states, if often not ranked as the poorest state in the country. You know, the thing that I think to notice specifically about Jackson, it's a majority black city, overwhelmingly majority black city, between 80-85%. The vast majority of the population is living, under $35,000 a year, many well below that. In the 20s, if not even below that. It's a city with very limited infrastructure, very limited economy at best right now. The largest employer in town collectively is the medical complex and the medical industry, and that's followed by government. Jackson is the state capital, so you have the city government. Jackson is the largest city in the state of Mississippi, and it's about barely 200,000 people. So by many people in your audience standards, it's not a lot at all. And the second largest employer is government, both the state government, to a certain extent, the federal government, and there are institutions that are here, and city government. And following that, you have the colleges and universities. We have Tougaloo, Jackson State, Mills, and several other smaller kind of colleges and universities here, as well as some of community college institutions that are here. Then after that, your fourth biggest employer, source of employment, is the transportation and trucking industry. So right now it's a very limited economy structured around those different things. There are some external factories. Many folks may know of the Nissan plant up in Canton, which is about 10 miles north of Jackson and employs a good number of residents of Jackson to it. And there's a union drive that's going on there with some mixed results, unfortunately, as of now. But there's a new kind of two-tiered structure that's there, which only exists in large part because of the laws and how they're structured here as a result of TAF, partly, and the right to work regime that exists in the state of Mississippi and the depressed socioeconomic conditions that exist here, which allow for these multinational corporations to kind of come here and do this level of exploitation and extraction.
You said the government is a large employer. Usually government jobs are somewhat better paying than poverty level. Why is that not the case in Jackson?
Federal government jobs are more to your federal or national standard, because that's something that's controlled in the most part by the Obama administration. So there's kind of there you have a prevailing wage, and those are some of the more prime and sought after jobs in the city. But this, the state government and the city government, they work on, I mean, peanut wages. You know, I worked for the city administration under Chokwe Lumumba. And from where I was working to when I came into the city, and I was in one of the higher paying positions, mind you, but it was about a $20,000 drop. And the way that that is, and that was roughly from about $65,000 to $45,000 per year. The main thing, the tax base is very low here. The city does not have the ability. We are one of the states, you know, that you have to get approval from the state government in order to raise any kind of municipal taxes. So even though there's been several initiatives and there's even a desire that's been demonstrated several times over that the people of Jackson are willing to kind of tax themselves to a greater degree, the Republican legislature and governor continually, you know, blocked that for their own ideological and political reasons. But it's tied to the economic base. You know, the wages are here. The tax base just isn't here at present. And so there's a lot of work that has to be done to kind of change those conditions. But then some of it, quite frankly, Doug, some of it is just political will.
And the auto plant up the road, that's really not spreading around any decent jobs? Is that strictly low wage or what?
No, you know, when they first came in, Nissan was willing to actually go with its national wages of, you know, what we call the Detroit wages here. They were willing to do that. And it was the state legislature which discouraged them from doing that and asked them, you know, kind of set some things in motion to kind of entice them to create a lower wage scale, which they did. And then just a couple of years ago, they kind of introduced what they're doing all throughout the country. They introduced their two-stage, you know, piece where now they're employing under the banner of temporary workers, you know, a second tier of folks who are doing the same amount of work, often through overtime, doing the same amount of hours, but they're not getting paid, you know, your standard $22 an hour wage. They're making about $9 an hour. And so it's had some spinoff, but it's very limited to Jackson.
$9 an hour. So in the auto industry, they're making about what you would make at Walmart.
Yeah, that's right.
And the state government, I guess, didn't want Nissan to drive up the general wage level, right? That was their interest?
Exactly.
What a government. My God. So, Cooperation Jackson, what kind of organization is it?
We are an emerging cooperative federation in a set of supporting institutions that we're creating along the way. We've just basically initiated and opened up two cooperatives, the Nubius Place Cafe and Catering Cooperative and Freedom Farms Urban Farming Cooperative. Those are the first two out the gate. We are also supporting institutions. So Cooperation Jackson serves as kind of an incubator for those institutions and other cooperatives that are kind of coming down the line. And then we're asking all those that want to join into a federation styled after the Mondragon Corporation, Cooperative Corporation in the Basque Country in Spain, which is a large inspiration for our model and our entire kind of setup. And so it's a federation, it's a school, it's an incubator, and then down the road, we're working with a number of regional partners to kind of set up a financial institution through the Southern Grassroots Economies Project to set up our own basically bank and lending institution. So that we can kind of continually to finance new projects and be able to kind of take the risks that we think are necessary that most of your standard banks and even credit unions won't take on worker-owned enterprises. So that in a nutshell is what Cooperation Jackson is becoming. You know, we're only a year and a half old, so we still got a lot of growth and development to do. But we made some pretty significant strides in a year and a half. In large part based upon a lot of prep work that had been done, I would say about 10 to 12 years prior, in the development of the Jackson-Cush plan, which the most, you know, noted thing of the execution of that plan was having Chokwe Lumumba be elected mayor of the city of Jackson in 2013. So we're executing this plan and we're moving forward. We anticipate a significant amount of growth over the course of the next year, opening up several more cooperatives, Online, we have an arts and culture cooperative called Revolutionary Renaissance, which is in some advanced stages of its planning and development, set to open. We have Mississippi Waste Alternative, which is a recycling and composting cooperative, which is developing in at a high level. So, you know, by the end of 2016, I think we'll have 4 to 5 different cooperatives that will be part of our solidarity network of cooperatives that comprise the federation that will be Cooperation Jackson.
And talk a bit more about the cooperative model. Workers all have to join the cooperative?
In our model, we want every single worker to be a member of the cooperative. We think that's essential. We operate on the principle of one vote, worker, one vote, you know, for the democratic process. But, you know, not everybody wants to do that. We've already encountered that to a certain extent. That does not mean that we will not work with those individuals. We are and we have. But we're still trying to, you know, impress upon them that them having more democratic rights and choosing when they work and how they work, the wages they receive, is a much more equal and equitable way of earning a living, you know. So that's where we're at with that.
And what about, is there a managerial hierarchy? Do the workers elect the managers, or how does that work?
No, we don't have anything to that scale as of yet. I think the thing that will probably get us to something of that type of scale, Doug, will be the recycling and composting. And in that scenario, particularly on the composting side, we've just kind of identified that there's at present some skill gaps, both in the management and operations aspect of how we envision that particular enterprise growing. So that is something we're probably going to have to recruit initially, someone to come in and operate that from outside. And we know that there's a different type of competitive orientation to that than there is, say, developing someone here in Jackson to do it. So that cooperative, you know, that working group is trying to figure that out and navigate that. That's part of its democratic process. They haven't fully landed on how they're going to decide that question, but at this point, there's just a recognized need within the democratic process that there's more skill than what presently exists. Now, that may wind up being that we wind up sending somebody for some training for 3 months to 6 months, you know, someone from Jackson to learn that industry, to learn that business, and then come back and bring that to the cooperative. You know, so there's a number of different things that are being looked at and explored. And we think the model itself, the democratic model of workers choosing and deciding, you know, how they're going to, you know, self-manage the enterprise, you know, makes those things possible. But we're based upon, again, following the Mondragon principle, we're based upon that are, to the extent that we have cooperatives that grow to a significant scale where there is a need for a level of management, that is something that would be democratically controlled by the workers. They will, you know, do the hiring and the firing or demotion, whatever that may be, amongst themselves as part of their self-management, and that the ratio of their compensation, you know, will be no more than 1/3 of 1 to 3 of what any of the workers are making. So that's a principle that's kind of written in stone inside of our various bylaws and various kind of structural documents.
I'm Sugatha Kaliokuna, who is with the Cooperation Jackson in Jackson, Mississippi. And you mentioned this earlier, but one of the central parts of the Mondragon model was they had a bank, a financing institution that was very important to financing the new enterprises, the existing enterprises, and, you know, there being payment relations with the outside world. You think that's an important part of your model, right?
Absolutely. The folks that we're working with, no credit, terrible credit, zero, you know, just so deeply in debt that if they try to pull their resources together and go to a traditional bank, they're automatically going to get rejected. And then the way, you know, these lending institutions are primarily structured in terms of the collateral that they want to extract, they much like to know who's the boss, and if something fails, you know, what property or what assets can I seize, or who's going to be responsible for this debt. And they don't like 10 people going to them saying, well, we're all the boss, and this is what we bring to the table. Cooperatives throughout the country and throughout the world have also faced that challenge. And then there's just, you know, things that we want to invest in, which are more necessarily for quality of life than they are going to make excessive profits that we deem to be important for our community. we're going to invest in those, you know, and our premium is that they are able to sustain themselves in two dimensions. You know, one, be able to sustain the business and sustain the workers who are there so they have to break even. But then we want them to operate on sustainable practices that protect our environment. So that's another kind of cost typically to business that we are putting on ourselves, you know, as a social debt or social burden. To kind of up the ante for our future that we're putting on, that we know certain things are not on paper going to be the most profitable of enterprises, that if we were to take that again to a traditional bank, they flat out reject us. But if we are determining this is important to us and we have the resources to do it, you know, we can structure that back so that there's, you know, a long-term payment, no interest, gift capital. Those are things that we have to build out, I think, in order for this model to really be as transformative as we envision it becoming.
And an ecological vision is at the core of what you're up to, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. We are in a zone that is very much threatened by climate change, both in terms of what it's going to do for Mississippi's largest economic endeavor, which is still farming. That is already undergoing some significant shifts as weather patterns change. The water table basically is kind of disappearing. You know, there's a drought that our county is and several others have been in now for 2 years. So we're already kind of feeling some of the overall tides. But, you know, with the rising sea level, large parts of Jackson, as we're not that far off from the Mississippi River and are very low, will likely be inundated, you know, at least within my children's lifetime, if all the projections hold true. So, you know, it's not just for some philosophical reasons that we're committed to that, which we are, but, you know, there's some practical reasons that we're trying to look ahead, you know, 4 to 5 generations in how do we play our part in building a model that transforms how things are produced, how they are distributed, and how they're consumed, because in all those different phases, you know, the life cycle of our kind of productive process, typically there's waste. You know, there's some kind of excessive carbon emission or extraction. We believe that we can change that, and we have to change that and be a model for others to kind of take our lead and following. And so to that extent, you know, we have begun really trying to craft out not only how we're going to do the businesses in a sustainable way, but what types of policies on a local level are needed to kind of reinforce that and to help our city transform. So we've developed a piece called the Jackson Just Transition Plan, which kind of spells out how we believe the city can become a zero emissions and a zero waste city in 10 years.
And you mentioned a waste management portion of the enterprise. What's that about?
Mississippi Waste Alternative, that one is, that's our recycling and composting when we're trying to build at the scale so that we can ensure, you know, over the period of, like I said, that decade, trying to be that model, that within a decade, we can ensure that our landfill is not putting any recyclable material in it, and that we take as much of the organic matter as we can gather, and that's going to take a lot of transforming people's habits, but we're invested in the education process to do that. But we want to also remove that stream of organic matter from the dumping cycle and then turn that back into organic compost that can then be used to refertilize the soils of Mississippi and beyond, because one of the major pieces to fighting climate change, actually unknown to a lot of people, is the quality of the soils, to kind of capture carbon in those soils that the plants can use that to grow and other kind of materials, and then, you know, do a major project of reforestation so that we're able to capture more carbon and help the planet heal itself to help us survive. So it has a comprehensive long-term vision that we're trying to integrate from the best practices that we've been studying, you know, around the world, and trying to figure out, you know, how do we incorporate them here in our local context in a way that makes sense and in a way that's transformative of changing not only, you know, economic and social relations, but overall power relations in the city and the state.
Many cooperatives have been started throughout history and across space that end up being wrecked by a number of things, managerial and technical challenges, the lack of good finance, and of course, in Mississippi's case, you have a fairly hostile or unfriendly political environment. How do you plan to deal with all these challenges?
Well, the one I can speak to the most, I think, is the hostile political environment. In some respects, that's actually a benefit for us because, you know, the choices are so stark and the choices are made so clear that people are much more receptive to any type of alternative on kind of whatever scale, at least in a lot of your black working class community, because folks are just searching for some way to improve their lives. So the conditions in some way actually are a benefit to a level of engagement with our project and with our ideas. You know, the piece with the finances, even with our model, you know, that's going to be a long-term challenge. I was recently, just this past weekend, at a conference in Cincinnati with the Cincinnati Union Co-op Initiative, where several representatives from Mondragon came, including two representatives from some of their banking institutions, of which they have several. And it was just sobering to hear how long it took them to get to the point to where they are now and how many failures and mistakes that they made over the course of a 50-year period to get to where they are now, to where kind of all told they have several billion dollars in that throughout their network that they can use to capitalize different business ventures within the Mondragon network and beyond. So, you know, we're trying to take a sobering approach to that on that level and trying to take a long-term view, which for us right now is about 20 years out. You know, we got to make it first through five, but about 20 years out, and looking at that and trying to be patient with some of that development. And then the other pieces, which I think are actually probably the most, in my study, building the culture and transforming folks' habit is just as can be just as detrimental as lack of financing to a cooperative. So we invest a lot of time in building a new culture, if you will, and trying to imbue our members with that so we have a firm and solid ground. But that's going to take time, you know, because we've all been trained to work in non-cooperative environments throughout our entire life. So just changing people's habits is not going to be easy. It's going to take time and a lot of struggle.
Yeah, we live in a culture that emphasizes competition and self-reliance, not cooperation, but also encourages a passivity
among
the population, especially among the poorer members of the population. So how do you fight that?
Well, again, I go back to the first point. The conditions here give us, I think, a little bit of advantage. You know, one thing to have such a hostile and reactionary political context, it makes things a lot clearer to folks, and they know kind of clearly what they're up against, and that kind of serves as a motivation within itself to kind of press back and fight back. And we benefit greatly from that, I think, here in Jackson, and particularly through a Cooperation Jackson. But there are sectors of the community which are deeply apathetic. There are sectors who engage us, and they're supportive. They come to different events. They don't often necessarily come to trainings. And there's definitely, you can kind of tell there's a, well, we're going to wait and see type attitude as opposed to getting in on the ground floor and helping to build and add capacity there. That dynamic is there without question. And, you know, we have pretty much kind of been trying to adopt what we call the show and prove orientation and mentality that, you know, the way that you beat apathy is to struggle for folks to become engaged, and you struggle for folks to become engaged by having practical things for them to do. Tangible things where they can kind of see immediate results, and that's what we're struggling for, you know. But I'd love to have, you know, I'd love to come back and talk to you in a year's time after we've had our cooperatives up and running to give you a sobering assessment of how well we've done in that. To this point, we've basically been running all volunteer crews, you know, within the working groups. No one gets paid. We've been going at that for a year and a half, and we've had a very high level of engagement. So I think that speaks a lot to folks' desire for change and they're willing to kind of press forward in this context.
Oh, well, we've got a date a year from now, so I'll be back in touch. But finally, you've mentioned Mondragon, but do you have any other models or comrades in the United States that you've been talking with or following or learning from?
Oh, a number of folks, you know, throughout the country. And we've very intentionally, you know, deliberately reached out and been trying to learn from any and everybody that we can, you know, from different aspects of it. So, you know, we're very close with the Mississippi Association of Cooperatives, MAC, which is a state component of the Federation of Southern Cooperatives. We're very much tied to that and our members of the Federation and getting tutelage from a lot of those who have been around and been in the struggle now for over 50 years, developing and operating cooperatives here in the South. We've been reaching out to and are a part of a long series of engagement with the U.S. Federation of Worker Co-ops, you know, on and on. So we've been tapping into a number of different things and trying to learn from a various number of experiences and management styles and, you know, looking from like the Cleveland model to the Arizmendi model out in California. You know, you name it, we've been studying it the past couple of years and trying to pick what fits best for us in our context and in learning along the way. You know, there's some things that we've, within our year and a half experience that we thought would work, we've put it to the test. It doesn't quite work for us, so we're making those adjustments. But, you know, it's the democratic practice and the democratic struggle that enables us to kind of make these changes and not be locked into things that just aren't going to work.
That was Kali Okuno of Corporation Jackson, Jackson, Mississippi. You can learn more about them and learn how to help them by visiting their website, cooperationjackson.org. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some of the first movement of Shostakovich's String Quartet No. 8, performed by the Sorrel Quartet. Till next week, bye.